Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Ella Kemp.
On the show this week, the true story that became a musical sensation, Everybody's Talking About Jamie, the latest film from Joe Lawler and Christine Molloy, Rose Plays Julie, and in Film Club, to celebrate 20 years since its premiere, we're taking the wig out of the box and revisiting Hedwig and the Angry Inch. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome back, listeners. David, welcome back from Venice.
Hey.
It's a pleasure to have you back on. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. I came back with a spot of COVID, which was which is always welcome, but no symptoms so far. So, nothing too bad on that front. But, yeah, just day eight of quarantine. What better way to enliven a quarantine than recording a Truth and Movies podcast? I mean,
we're broadening your horizons. We're reaching out to you.
It's a tonic.
Ella, welcome back to the show. So you've been on the podcast before, but a while ago. And since we've relaunched the podcast, as we did that earlier in the year, we like to reintroduce all our regular contributors. So Ella Kemp, who are you and what do you do? The big question.
It's lovely to be back. Thanks for having me. I am a film critic. I write for Empire, for NME, for Little White Lies, and I run the film section at The Quietus and the Girls on Top's editorial platform.
Yeah, you're one of the hardest working, busiest people.
Oh,
I know. So but what sort of films are your jam, if you were introducing yourselves to our listeners? Do you have a particular spot, a particular track that you like to run?
I do. So, I mean, my prepared answer for my favourite film of all time, this is really going to upset David, and I know this in advance, and I forgot this before I came on the podcast, but here we are. It's Moulin Rouge. I'm sorry. I'm not proud. I feel like I've ruined the mood of the podcast already, but, you know, that's me.
No apology required, because of course this is quite a musical week,
exactly.
Right? So the perfect guest for these films. And do you like talking, Ella?
Do I like talking? I don't not enjoy talking.
Because this week everybody's talking about a particular person. Everybody's talking about Jamie. Everybody's talking about Jamie. This celebratory musical spectacle follows teenager Jamie New, who dreams of a life on stage. While his classmates plan their livelihoods after they leave school, Jamie contemplates revealing his secret career ambition to become a fierce and proud drag queen. So, Ella, you said you were a big musicals fan. Did you have much of a history with Everybody's Talking About Jamie beforehand?
I actually didn't. I mean, Everybody's Talking About Jamie was one of those things that I would see the posters all the time on the tube, and every single time I'd say, I should go and see this because the posters are still here and everyone still loves it. But never got round to it. And then, you know, theatre stopped for a very long time and now there's a film. So I was like, oh, well, you know, I suppose I don't need to as much. But no, I didn't really know anything about it at all. So it was such a nice surprise. I had such a lovely time.
Oh, wow. So introduce us a little bit to the film then. What should we expect if we've only seen the posters beforehand?
So it is a full-blooded movie musical, which I think is done really, really well. It's very earnest, it's very theatrical, it's very direct. I think it's very unapologetic in how sweet it is and how cheesy it is, but I think that's an asset, because I can think of a lot of movie musicals in the last couple of years which are just a bit flat and who just rely on the songs a bit too much, like assuming that the audience knows those songs and therefore nobody needs to act or believe a word of what they're saying. Whereas I felt like with Everybody's Talking About Jamie, they were trying so hard with every second to be like, come on, like, you're invited, like, this, look how much this matters, look how high stakes this 16-year-old's life in Sheffield.
Yeah,
look how high stakes it is, which I really appreciated.
David, did you appreciate Everybody's Talking About Jamie? We've talked before about your taste in musicals. Were you a fan of this one?
Well, just to go back to something before, yeah, I'm not a massive fan of Moulin Rouge, but I respect all tastes and creeds, and you know this let there be no antagonism between us for that. You know, I don't resent you at all, not much.
Thank
anyway.
Thank you, David.
So. Yeah, I guess I had a similar experience of like every tube escalator ride going past three smiling Jamies, like every time. And I think my perception of it was that it was something that it started as a kind of smaller production in Sheffield and then sort of graduated to the West End quite quickly. And I think my perception of it was that it was a bit kind of edgy and unique and interesting, and I think what one of the things that I maybe didn't shine to the film so much about was like discovering it, the story, as being fairly tame. I thought like it felt to me like a very very simple kind of coming of age story where you have a central character who you're rooting past, almost like the kind of Billy Elliot arc where you have Northern Town iconoclast railing against the arrogance and ignorance of peers, parents, all that. You have the sort of loving mother and the father who's like, oh, he's just a fairy. And you know, I was surprised at how kind of like I almost felt like that it wasn't doing enough or going far enough. It was very kind of it almost felt like a throwback to like a decade, two decades ago. Like you look at some of the art about this kind of subject area now and it feels like we're sort of moving on and you know, it kind of like, I realize that there is still a lot of, you know, people who aren't accepting of like these kind of people and like, you know, lifestyles and certain sort of sexualities, but this felt quite sort of like, it felt weird to see like we're back at the kind of homophobic old dad kind of stereotype. There was a bit of a, I don't know. I found the film maybe a little bit, a bit of a kind of ITV2 energy. Like it felt like something that you'd see on TV rather than a film, like in the cinema. And I guess it'll probably work better as a kind of streaming thing on Amazon Prime than it would in a cinema maybe. I thought the songs were decent. It, you know, the central performance was very game and you know, he really kind of goes for it, and the you know, he can do everything that needs to be done, the singing, the dancing. But yeah, they're just felt something a little bit school playish about it. Sharon Horgan, it was a very strange to see her in that role. I mean, what did you guys think about that? Like she felt like kind of countercasting to me, where she's playing a teacher she's like the baddie teacher, which you kind of don't really expect of someone who is like, you know, not that.
Well, Ella, let's talk about casting in a second, but I suppose, David, some context to what you're saying. If it feels at all out of date, or you know, maybe slightly past it, it's working all the way back to the source. It was based on a documentary that was on telly a decade ago now, 10 years ago, and about that sort of specificity of the story, of course, the blurb we just read sounds like it's going to be this great coming-of-age drag queen odyssey, when really the central plot is just Jamie New is a graduating teenager and wants to wear a dress to his prom. And that's what the documentary is. It's such a specific thing. And the documentary plays like a Billy Elliot or, you know, or any of those late 90s sort of kitchen sink meets popcorn film like Full Monty or Brassed Off. It's, yeah, but does this work now? And I suppose the casting is part of it. So Ella, let's go through some of those casting choices. David mentioned Sharon Horgan. I guess they're bringing in a few familiar faces like Sarah Lancashire, who has an incredible TV career, not much of a film career, but also the big thing about the lead character, Jamie New, is we have a new Jamie in Max Harwood. So do you want to start with Max and work down the cast? Any highlights, lowlights?
Yeah, I was so impressed by Max. It's his first ever screen role. And it's, I don't know, I think that tends to happen a lot with movie musicals. Like, I remember when Netflix adapted Prom, they'd cast a newcomer to play the teenage girl in it. Another film about a girl who wants to go to prom. And she was great. She was a very good singer, but I just didn't believe anything she was saying. Whereas I think Max Harwood was just, I was so impressed. I thought he just has this kind of confidence about him and this weird kind of elegance as well. And just very, I think he seems very comfortable as a performer, while playing this teenager who is obviously, you know, grappling through with these things, which are, he's got these struggles and things are awkward and difficult. But as someone who's supposed to carry a film, I thought it was so convincing. Great singing voice, very good dancer. And I'd be really curious to watch him just act in more films. And I don't often find that with, you know, newcomers in musicals who are just there because they're really good singers. So, well done, Max Harwood. I enjoyed your performance.
Keep an eye out for him in the future. Yeah. But we should talk about, I mean, one of the other big stars who's in this version of Jamie, which is Richard E. Grant, with, you know, a Northern accent. It's quite a choice. It's his set in Sheffield, so he decided to commit to that. What did we make of Richard E. Grant in this?
I mean, I'm always happy to see him. I'm glad he's here. I'm glad he's doing things. I don't know how much him being cast in this role made sense to me. I think in some of these instances where you have an actor who you know in an unlikely role, I get this very cathartic, like satisfying moment where I think, oh, that makes complete sense. Why didn't I ever think of it? I didn't quite think that for this one. I was just like, oh, nice to see him, I guess. I can't do a Northern accent to save my life, so I cannot comment on how good his accent was. I noticed that, you know, he doesn't usually do that. His singing voice was good. He can walk in heels.
It does come in and out, doesn't it? And he has the benefit of when his song comes in, he's replaced by Holly Johnson of Frankie Goes to Hollywood, one of the great singing voices.
Okay, I did wonder, well, yeah, I thought, oh, suddenly this is incredible. Well done, Richard, what have you done? Yeah, that was good.
I did. That is an amazing piece of trivia. I kind of thought that, like, it's one of those things where I was watching it thinking, hold on, you've just been nominated for an Oscar. And this was your, like, choice of, like, this is my bounce back. This is what I'm going to do next. I was trying to sort of, like, untangle that in my mind, that it just seemed like a very strange, I guess maybe a little bit different for him, maybe him wanting to sort of get the cobwebs out and try sort of like something more Widow Twanky panto type thing. But yeah, it's a strange performance, I think. But not like it. Definitely, kind of like you're on your toes when he's on the screen, because anything can happen. And I think there are those, you know, little funny moments where his very kind of, you know, posh London accent comes through, like at the end of sentences. So yeah, it's a bit of a tightrope walk with him with the accent, but no, not unpleasurable, I'd say.
I've been recommended, you know, talking about the accent in this, that go and check out Richard E. Grant's series Right Around the World on iPlayer, where it sounds like he assumes the roles of various writers throughout history, like Hemingway and Dickens. I don't know. He's someone who has such a specific personality on screen and such a specific voice and physicality that why would you try to mess with that? But let's put some scores and final comments on everybody's talking about Jamie. Ella, I'll come to you first. So these are 3 scores out of 5 in anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect.
I would go for 3 in anticipation because I thought it would be flat and terrible, like many, many other movie musicals I've seen, including, I'm sorry, I have to name it, Amazon's Cinderella, which I think is trying to do similar things musically and is a, I think, is a complete failure. But then for coming back to Jamie, I would give it 4 for enjoyment. Probably 4 in retrospect. I think I had a really nice time and I think it's doing what it wanted to do really well.
Mm-hmm. And Ella, before we go to David, David mentioned this might play better at home than in the cinema. What do you think about on that point?
Both times I watched it at home and I kind of wish I watched it in a cinema, just because I think it's... I think a lot of people who go and see it in the cinema, I would expect would know the songs to an extent, and I think there's always a bit of a nice atmosphere when, you know, in a kind of Greatest Showman sort of way, when you know, when everyone's on the same page, there's just a nice lively atmosphere, I think. But I enjoyed it at home, so both, why not?
Yeah. Why not both? David, what are your scores?
Well, I think I was going to give it 3s, and then I sort of saw Hedwig again, and I was like, no, this is just so much better. So I think it's going to be like 3-2-2 from me. I don't know. I'm not part of the cult. It just didn't land for me. It felt too sort of theatrical, displaced to a cinema screen. And I thought, yeah, Max Harwood, very good, but otherwise the songs just didn't work and the story just felt very kind of minor key for a musical. I don't know. I feel like with a musical, you need something bigger. But hey-ho.
Well, there you have it, listeners. Two very different takes on Jamie. If you see the film this weekend, whether at home or in the cinema, do let us know what you make of it at the usual channels, at LW Lies on Twitter or truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. Up next, we have Rose Plays Julie.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Veterinary student Rose decides to contact Ellen, the birth mother who gave her up for adoption. Ellen, a successful London-based actress, doesn't want to know. Undeterred, Rose is led by her curiosity and discovers a series of revelations that shake the fragile identity she has built for herself. So David, Joe Lawler and Christine Molloy, very quietly, two of the most exciting filmmakers, I think, in the British film industry, putting out a film every couple of years. Could you introduce The Desperate Optimists to us very quickly and tell us what they're doing with Rose Plays Julie?
Yeah. They're Irish. They're now based in London. They are they've been making they started in kind of experimental theatre And then they moved to cinema. They did the series of short films, which came under this banner of Civic Life, which kind of were many of which were kind of like long 10-minute takes, like a whole like reel of film, and there were these intricate kind of tracking shots. But kind of before the time when doing intricate tracking shots was a kind of like must have in your kind of, you know, Oscar bait movie. And then they moved to features. They did they've only done sort of three fiction features and a doc, and I think they're working on another doc now. They had a bit of a breakthrough in 2007 with this film called Helen, which was kind of like a really interesting arty kind of Antonioni thing of a, and it's a, I guess it's a sort of similar setup of a, it's a film about a girl who goes missing, and then that they decide to make a reenactment, and then the girl who's playing the girl who's gone missing kind of really almost sort of takes over her life, like that Antonioni The Passenger style kind of setup. This one is like very much a, feels like a kind of a piece with Helen, in that you have a woman who of unknown parentage who goes on this kind of journey of self-discovery when she comes of age, and finds all these kind of dark revelations about who she is, how she was brought up, why she's in the situation she is. And I think what initially begins as quite a sort of cerebral, dramatic, quite sort of interior actory kind of film, and like almost kind of merges very subtly into this kind of like quite mind-melting kind of revenge thriller that kind of works on these levels that's almost kind of Christopher Nolan-esque when it comes to, like, you know, the motivations and why people are doing things and where they're doing it. And it's an amazing kind of high wire sort of plotting act that where you get from like point A in the beginning to point B at the end. But yeah, I loved it. I mean, it's I think it's their most ambitious film. It's really also quite bold and brave in what it's trying to do and say. And I think it's definitely a film that kind of, you know, is built to provoke debate. It doesn't really offer easy answers or easy outcomes. Even the ending, I think, is, you know, if people come away from it saying they hate the ending, I'd be like, yeah, fine, I believe you. You know, I'm not going to try and convince you otherwise. But I feel the filmmakers have like engineered it in that way. They don't want a kind of like, you know, satisfying cozy closure. They want something that is more kind of dirty, nasty, stick in your craw kind of thing. And I think the film achieves it.
Wow. Dirty, nasty. Ella, was this your jam?
I was really impressed by this. I was impressed by it. I saw it like 2 years ago before the pandemic, mm-hmm. In the cinema, and it completely took me by surprise. And then rewatching it, I think I felt ever so slightly more muted on it. But because I think a lot of it, as David was saying, is in the really kind of surprising plotting, which comes out of nowhere. And I just had no idea what was going on the first time, whereas the second time, well, you know, I knew it was happening. But yeah, I think it's really good. And I think I appreciated how calm and clinical it is in a way. Like, it's got all of these dirty, nasty, complicated things, but it's not graphic. It doesn't yell. It doesn't explode. It doesn't scream. And there's nothing wrong with films like that that do. But I quite appreciate revenge thrillers, particularly ones about women, which keep things really restrained. And you've got this central performance in here from Anne Skelly as Rose, who is just incredible. And she just is so powerful in a really, really measured way. Some parts of it reminded me a little bit of Carey Mulligan in Promising Young Woman, just in terms of keeping it all in and just having this kind of deadpan like resolve throughout it. You know, you think that she should break, or there's a moment where she's gonna just completely lose it, and she never does. And considering how much younger Anne Skelly is, and I haven't seen her in many things, certainly far fewer than Carey Mulligan, I thought she was great. I thought, yeah, it was really convincing.
two great discoveries of young actors there for you, Ella, this week. One treat for me with the films by Lawler and Malloy is their continuing collaboration with Aidan Gillen, an actor who, when he's in films, you know, like, you know, Dark Knight Rises or whatever, is often underused, whereas they really know how to use him. Mr. John is a great example of that. Is he? What's he like in this one? Are they? How does he appear?
Terrifying. In a good way. He made my skin crawl, but in lots of different ways. Repeatedly, you'd kind of first introduce him, and you can tell that he's mysterious and complex, and there's something very sinister going on there. And then it just becomes even more insidious, and again, it never quite resorts to this extreme brutality on screen, at least. Just really unsettling. I don't know, I found his performance in this is one that I kept thinking about in a way that I didn't want to keep thinking about it. He just stuck in my mind, and I was like, why are you still there? Yeah, but I guess that's good. Well done.
I think the thing about him is that the way they kind of draw him is so counterintuitive to the kind of, I mean, and again, it's, I think, again, his character is very similar to like the Bo Burnham character in Promising Young Woman, in that they're not painting him as like, you know, evil incarnate. They're trying to sort of mess with this idea that, you know, these people who have done things in their lives can come across when you meet them as just completely lovely, normal, nice people, but actually, you know, the sort of the dark heart is there. And I think Aidan Gillen is just very, very good at doing that. But yeah, I read somewhere that he wasn't like that. He really had to be convinced to do this role. I don't think he was like completely game initially, but eventually came on board. So, but yeah, I can imagine, you know, it's quite a sort of complex character to sort of bring to life.
Right. So let's put some scores on Rose Plays Julie. David, I'll come to you first.
Yeah, I'd probably say it's 4 for anticipation, 4 for enjoyment, 5 in retrospect. I think it's kind of, yeah, it's a film that sort of toys with you while you're watching it. It kind of takes you in many different directions, and you know, I wouldn't be lying when I said there are some moments in the film where I kind of bridled and thought, "What we're doing? This is happening? Or are we going here? I can't believe that." But it's definitely one that the more you know, it sits with you, you think about it, you kind of unpick it, unlock it, and yeah, it just sort of makes more sense in the rear view.
Ella?
I'm gonna go 3-4-3, I think. I was very, very, very shocked, very gripped while watching it, but I think the more I thought about it, I'm kind of framing it against a lot of other thrillers in this sort of genre, and I think it's solid, but it's not, I think, because it's so restrained and sure of what it's doing in its own world, that it stayed in its world and I stayed a little bit distant from it. But I think it's a very, very subjective one, like all of the ones in this kind of subgenre, so I very much understand a 5 in retrospect as well. Yeah, very impressive.
Fantastic. So those are your two new releases this week, listeners. Up next, we're going to Film Club for Hedwig and the Angry Inch. So here is the blurb for Hedwig and the Angry Inch from its very recent release from the Criterion Collection. With this trailblazing musical, writer-director-star John Cameron Mitchell and composer-lyricist Stephen Trask brought their signature creation from stage to screen for a movie as unclassifiable as its protagonist. Raised a boy in East Berlin, Hedwig undergoes a traumatic personal transformation in order to emigrate to the US, where she reinvents herself as a divinely talented rock diva. The film tells Hedwig's life through her music, an eclectic assortment of original punk anthems and power ballads. So, Ella, I'll come to you first on this, because it's always fun with Film Club to talk about our experiences, our first experiences of this film. This was a first watch of the film for me, and this was always a rainy day movie that I knew I'd come to one day, because way back when, gosh, you know, however many years, back in 2005, when I was a teenager, I went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And on my first night there, I met some friends. I was still at high school. Some of my friends who'd gone to uni dragged me along to a show that was in a dingy bar that was the Hedwig and the Angry Inch show, which was being put on by students. And the actual stage show is done just as a live gig where narrative stuff happens around the edges of the songs. And I had no idea what I was going through. But then after that, I followed John Cameron Mitchell's career through Short Bus and How to Talk to Girls at Parties, Rabbit Hole, his acting on TV, which has been terrific. And then finally watching this was such a treat for me. But was this a first watch for you, Hedwig and the Angry Inch? What did you make of it?
It was a first watch for me. I mean, I went in completely blind. I'd heard the title, vaguely seen some posters, maybe a still or two. But no, I had no idea. And I had the best time. I think the moment that I really was just... it kind of clicked for me and I thought, oh, this is incredible, was when they started singing The Origin of Love, a song that I love, and I never realised it was from there. And so I had to pause the film, was frantically Googling it. And I was like, this can't be from this film. Like, they've taken this from somewhere else. And they haven't. And it's from this film. And it's so good. Yeah, I had such a good time. I think... It's interesting hearing about the stage show is kind of more focused on the songs and having a little bit of narrative like to the sides of it, which is how I felt watching the film. Like, I cared a lot more about the performances than narrative that did or didn't happen. I don't know if that's because I thought the narrative was weak or the songs were so good. But either way, I don't know. I enjoyed that kind of musical experience, placing so much importance on the performances rather than having this story in which you have to shoehorn songs, which is just my least favourite thing about this genre, as and when you can tell that people are really kind of clutching at straws to try and like squeeze a song in there. But yeah, it's such a good time. And again, I watched it at home and would love to see it on a big screen, particularly with, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of very, very passionate fans who know all the beats really well.
Absolutely. David, you mentioned rewatching Hedwig and the Angry Inch diminished Jamie in your mind. So, can you tell us what was it like revisiting it, and what was your take the first time you saw it as well?
Yeah, I remember seeing it when it came out in the cinemas, just not really knowing anything about it and enjoying it. I mean, I think I must have enjoyed it because I've got like a kind of original release DVD which I kind of bought out of mothballs to watch again. But yeah, no, it's such a fun film, and I think rewatching it, I was just really blown away by the kind of just the sheer quality of it, like the inventiveness of all the kind of the titles and the production design, John Cameron Mitchell's performance, the songs themselves, the sort of storyline and how the story is kind of visualized. It just works so well, and I think one of the things I found really I find it really funny, actually, the like John Cameron Mitchell's delivery. I tell you what it reminded me of, like, in a good way. So one of my favorite scenes in all of cinema, and I'm sure it is yours too, is from the film Austin Powers. And it's the sequence where Dr. Evil does his like weird monologue in therapy, where he's talking about summers in Rangoon, luge lessons, all that kind of stuff. And when Hedwig's doing the stage banter, it's almost as good as that. I think it's got that kind of really dry, you know, that bit where she says, oh, they threw tomatoes at me, I made a salad, you know. it just very really funny, wry delivery. But yeah, I mean, I think the thing about this film is you know, seeing it again, I'm kind of surprised that it hasn't, to my knowledge, still a hit on the kind of late night circuit. I'm surprised that places like, you know, Prince Charles in cinema in London aren't doing it as like a kind of Friday night midnight screening. No, obviously they're doing lots and lots of other amazing stuff, and there's no disrespect to you know, the best cinema in London, but like, you know, I kind of thought it had that sort of Rocky Horror Picture Show energy that you could actually, like, you know, you'd have people dressing up, you'd have people going in the kind of, you know, what's that kind of hair, that sort of Charlie's Angels, what's that hairstyle called, that's kind
it's,
of
it's like a shag, like a shaggy, yeah, haircut. It's trendy again now, everyone's getting them now. Oh, they should start spreading Hedwig again. Yeah,
this is it, this is the reason for the Hedwig revival. But yeah, you know, it would totally slay.
Yeah, I think that speaks quite directly to the unfortunate release date this film had of the 12th of September 2001, which just meant that it had no real cinema release. No one really went to see this film. I think in new, particularly Broadway musical circles, it was a big deal, and they've had revivals on stage, but the film maybe didn't catch hold in that cult sense. It is so amazing how... you know, you talk about, David, like sort of imperfect films or films that aren't cozy and fully satisfying. And this is one that has so many ideas and so much energy to it that it isn't a perfect film. But isn't that better than something that is polished to being inoffensive? And John Cameron Mitchell does have that presence on the screen where he is kind of amazing and overwhelming, but also a little bit aggravating and grating at times. It's used so well in his recent reinvention as a TV actor in stuff like Shrill and The Good Fight.
I mean,
and...
his next role is wild. He has been cast as Joe Exotic, he of Tiger King fame, from that of Lockdown 1 fame, and watching Hedwig for the first time, I know who John Cameron Mitchell is, but I haven't watched loads of his stuff. But watching Hedwig, I was like, yeah, this kind of wild, sad, theatrical, ridiculous, weirdly moving energy makes sense in a strange way for whatever and whoever Joe Exotic is. I can't believe I'm now looking forward to watching that, but because of Hedwig I am. What a world.
I think it's sad. Like, I know, I'd be interested to know what his kind of, you know, if he's made a sort of choice to actually pivot from doing movies and directing to more acting stuff. I know that How to Talk to Girls at Parties was not a big success. But it troubles me that someone like John Cameron Mitchell, after having made something like Hedwig and even Short Bus, to a sense, that what, you know, why isn't he directing the Amazon Presents Cinderella? You know, like, what, why isn't he doing these things that are actually going to bring a bit more kind of credibility and edge and originality to these films, rather than the absolute kind of, you know, templated, dim-witted, safe versions that are kind of being churned out for you know, Friday night on the wine, you know, like, it troubles me that he hasn't been scooped up and embraced into Hollywood's teat.
Well, I think we know why a filmmaker like him isn't making films like that, because of the, you know, the fault lines between what was in the 80s and 90s queer cinema, and this is maybe just on the final cusp of that, the edge of that, and then how those things are co-opted into more mainstream fare in the last 15 years by major productions like Cinderella.
David, do you think John Cameron Mitchell's Moulin Rouge would be like? Another film. The only reason I bring it up as well is because Moulin Rouge also came out in 2001, and it came out a couple months after Hedwig, I think. So it came at a moment when people were looking several months later for that kind of comfort. So I think it did much better once it actually came out on home entertainment. What would have happened if he would have made Moulin Rouge?
Oh, I don't know. I think Moulin Rouge is kind of pure Baz Luhrmann, and I think it's, in that sense, I think it works as a movie. I just I mean, I just find the film like headache inducing. In it's kind of it's this kind of onslaught of like stuff, and I just find it very tiring film to watch. But yeah, I don't know what John Cameron Mitchell would have. I mean, you know, that I guess they're sort of like birds of a feather in a way. They're slightly kind of alternative movie musicals and that deal with kind of camp and the sort of myth, fairy tales, myths and things like that. But yeah, I don't know. Moulin Rouge is just the film I'll never come around to. I think it's the first film. Sorry, last thing. It's the first film I really remember going to the cinema and having like, because you know, going to the cinema when you're young, you could be watching like, you know, static on the screen, and it'd be like, this is fun, I'm not at home. But that was one of the first films that I genuinely remember thinking, I'm not having a good time in the cinema. I'm really.
You would have rather watched Static than Moulin Rouge. I would have rather.
Not saying I'd rather. Well, maybe now that I'm into like James Benning films and things like that. But you know, yeah, Moulin Rouge was my first bad time in the cinema. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Well, yeah. This became a very inadvertent film club. segment on Moulin Rouge.
No disrespect to the many millions of Moulin Rouge lovers, including Ella. This is my problem, not yours.
Ella, you thought that this was being too conventional a program. We needed David to drop one of his controversial takes.
That's what I'm here for.
We're getting back the way we used to be before the pandemic. I will say before we sign off on Hedwig, though, the soundtrack is great, and if maybe the spirit of a film like this wasn't continued on screen, I would recommend going and checking out the albums of the punk rock band Against Me. There's a concept album called Transgender Dysphoria Blues when their lead singer Laura Jane Grace went through gender confirmation experiences and turned it into a concept album. It has that raw punk rock spirit that this film does as well. It's definitely worth checking that out. I'd love to see Hedwig get reappraised and reassessed and revived. I'd see how it's aged, see how it's aged like a fine wine or aged like an old ratty denim jacket maybe. But anyway, David, Ella, thank you so much for joining me this week. Listeners, let us know what you make of any of the films we talked about this week at the usual channels, at LWLies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email. Next week we have The Sopranos prequel The Many Saints of Newark, we have The Green Knight, and for Film Club, we're going to go back to a crime classic for Gomorrah. Listeners, subscribe wherever you pod. If you're a podcast player of choice that's in the reviews, we'd love you to leave one for us there. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.